Good morning, Chicago.
Good morning.
I'm Chris Lamb, and I was working in the newsroom of the Daytona Beach News Journal in Daytona Beach, Florida in early 1993, and I received a phone call that would change my life. I'd been working on a story on a local nonprofit that was raising money for the homeless and keeping it when I received a call from someone who said they had some information for me, but the only way that he would share it with me if I came to his house. And I asked him who he was. Jesus Christ, he said. I was skeptical. You know how it is when you hear someone's voice for the first time and it doesn't quite match up with what you thought the person would sound like? You know, Jesus, I was expecting maybe James Earl Jones or Vin Scully. This guy sounded like Gomer Pyle or maybe Goober Pyle. I'm not sure I could tell the difference between the two of them. But I asked him, how do you have this information? And he said, I'm Jesus Christ. I said, I'm not questioning you, but if I left the newsroom every time someone called me and said they were Jesus Christ, I never get any work done. I need some proof that you are who you say you are. I said, what do you need? He said, well, you have a birth certificate, right? And it has your name on it, right? And next to Father, it says God? I mean, could you fax that to me? At which point he released a torrent of curse words and hung up. I don't think it was Jesus Christ. But this was not the phone call that changed my life. That came a few hours later when I got a phone call from a PR guy who worked for the city of Daytona Beach. He asked me if I knew that Jackie Robinson had once played in Daytona Beach, and I thought he was BSing me. I had never heard that Jackie Robinson had played in Daytona Beach. The guy put me in touch with Billy Rowe, who had worked for the Pittsburgh Courier, the best black newspaper in America, and had been at Robinson's first spring training with the Montreal Royals, the AAA team in the Brooklyn Dodgers organization in 1946. Billy Rowe had accompanied Wendell Smith, the newspaper's sports editor, and they were present at the creation. Billy Rowe told me about that spring training. He told me about when Jackie and Rachel finally arrived after a 40-hour trip from California to Daytona Beach. Hell could hardly be worse than the racial indignities they experienced on their way to Florida. Robinson had come to make history. Robinson had come to confront the color line. Wendell Smith and Billy Rowe were the only sports writers at the Greyhound bus terminal. One of the most important stories in baseball history, and only two sports writers were there when Robinson got off the bus. Robinson played his first game 2 weeks later with the Montreal Royals when they played the Brooklyn Dodgers, their parent club, at Citi Field in downtown Daytona Beach. Wendell Smith and Billy Rowe went to cover the game, but they had to do so from the segregated section down the right field line. The Baseball Writers Association prohibited black sports writers. Black sports writers could not get press cards, couldn't go on the field, couldn't go in the dugouts, the dressing rooms, the press boxes. Billy Rowe remembered sitting about 100, 150 feet away from the infield, craning his neck as far as it would go so he could get a photo of Robinson before the game on the infield. Leo Durocher, the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, sees him and yells at Rowe, "You can't get a photo from there. Get on the field." Rowe knew he wasn't allowed on the field, but Durocher yelled again, "And you do what Leo Durocher tells you to do." If Leo Durocher had told you to strip naked, cover yourself in butter and mushrooms, and crawl through a village of starving cannibals, you would do it. So Rowe walks across the field, and all of a sudden he hears this piercing voice say, "Get that N-word off the field." Rose freezes, and Durocher waves him on. Leo Durocher, Rowe remembered, then went to the manager of the ballpark and says, "If you don't find out who called, who used that word, and have him removed, there will be no game." This was the largest crowd in the history of the ballpark. Rowe remembered seeing a white guy being dragged out of the ballpark screaming, "Holy hell." He says, "I don't know if they got the right guy or not, but they dragged somebody out of the park," he remembered with a laugh. The game went on as scheduled. When I wrote my column after interviewing Roe, I was told the newspaper had always mentioned the fact that the stands were integrated that day, and why hadn't I mentioned that? Because it wasn't true. Nothing was said about it in the contemporary accounts in the white newspapers, which wasn't surprising, but nothing was also said in the black newspapers, and Wendell Smith probably would have mentioned that, I thought. This information had probably been manufactured in the decades after to make it appear that the people of Daytona Beach were transformed by Jackie Robinson. They weren't transformed. I was. When I went on to work on my PhD in August of that year, what do you think I wrote my dissertation on? I wrote my dissertation on the limits of satire and editorial cartooning. My arm's dead, but I can still throw a curveball. My first two books were on the limits of editorial cartooning and Blackout, the untold story of Jackie Robinson's first spring training. 30 years later, Jackie Robinson still has a hold on me. 30 years later, Jackie Robinson still inspires me. I have written or edited 5 books on baseball, race, and the press, including my latest, Stolen Dreams, the 1955 Cannon Street All-Stars and Little League Baseball Civil War. This is the story of a black Little League All-Star team in Charleston, South Carolina, that registered for a segregated tournament in 1955 and all hell broke loose. White teams refused to play this black 11 and 12 year olds. Little League Baseball told the white teams they would have to play the Cannon Street All-Stars because Little League Baseball prohibited racial discrimination. Hundreds of teams in the South left Little League Baseball to create a segregated youth baseball league. It's now called Dixie Baseball. Cannon Street team won 2 tournaments by forfeit and advanced to the regional tournament in Rome, Georgia, 1 tournament away from the Little League World Series. Little League Baseball then lost their nerve and declared the Cannon Street team ineligible because it had advanced. Its rule said a team had to advance by winning on the field and could not do so by forfeit. White newspapers, who rarely said anything about racism or segregation in 1955, condemned the racists in the South and Little League Baseball. But what made this story different? What made this story so different from so many other unreported stories about racism? Because I think it had to do with 11-year-old boys who were denied the chance to play in the All-American game of baseball. A couple weeks later, Emmett Till was lynched in Money, Mississippi, and white newspapers in the North first started paying attention to racism. I'll be signing copies of Stolen Dreams at 9 o'clock. Please remain in your seats now. There's no reason to panic. Safety first at Sabre. There'll be enough books for all of you. Now, this is what I've learned from 30 years of researching baseball, the press, and the color line. Journalism has always been called, or has been called, the first draft of history. But what about these stories excluded in the first draft? What becomes of these untold pieces of history? Is it still history? Or does it fade into some never-never land, never to be spoken about again? We depend on journalists to tell us what happened, but what if these stories are ignored, neglected, or falsely reported? What if the stories of extraordinary black ball players are buried under unmarked graves and remain there for decades or forever, until these stories are rescued by researchers at Sabre, who revive the stories of men like Moses Fleetwood Walker and Bud Fowler and put their names on gravestones, and in doing so acknowledge them and give them the dignity that escaped them when they were living. This is one of the reasons I'm a member of Sabre. It's a reason I donate to Sabre. I'm now going to interrupt this pledge drive and return to a regularly scheduled presentation. Baseball has long held a particular grip on black men who played the game or some version of it. Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, wrote about baseball or something like it as he recalled his days as an enslaved man in Maryland. Douglass's son, Charles, played on two black teams in Washington, D.C. that fought for equal opportunity on the baseball fields in the 1860s. He wrote letters to his father about baseball. Frederick Douglass was an honorary member of his son's team. Octavius Cato recognized how baseball could serve to advance racial equality in Philadelphia. In 1867, his team applied for membership in a white organization, the Pennsylvania chapter of the Association of Amateur Baseball Players. The team withdrew its application when they knew it wouldn't be accepted. 2 months later, the organization would formally ban black players. Cato was a civil rights activist. He fought for the integration of trolley cars. He fought for the right to the right for blacks to vote until he was murdered on election day in 1861. James Weldon Johnson, who wrote "Lift Every Voice and Sing," the black national anthem, and was president of the NAACP, who fondly remembered the curveball he threw as a kid and his talent for the game. William Clarence Matthews, the pupil of Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee Institute, would become a star player, baseball player at Brown University in the early 1900s, and was so good that the story was a major league team tried to sign him, but could not do so because of the color line. Matthews later became one of the most prominent black lawyers in America and served as chief counsel for black separatist Marcus Garvey. There's playwright August Wilson, whose protagonist in his Pulitzer Prize winning play Fences, Troy Maxson, a Negro League slugger, who worked as a garbage collector after his physical talents had given up on him. And then there's the painter Rumier Bearden, who talked about being so good at baseball that Philadelphia Athletics owner Connie Mack wanted to sign him to a contract, but told Bearden he would have to pass for white. Bearden refused. I'm trying to confirm this story. Here is what else I've learned from 30 years as researching baseball, the press, and the color line. Baseball is a part of the history of who we are as Americans. It's not separate from it. You cannot understand the story of segregation in America without an understanding of baseball, no more than you can understand the story of integration of America without an understanding of what was happening in baseball. During the several decades of Jim Crowism, white Americans knew little or nothing about black lawyers, politicians, doctors, educators, inventors, and writers, because the white press said nothing about them. But many whites knew about black athletes because their names and sometimes their photos appeared on sports pages, because they sometimes competed against white athletes in boxing and college football, in the Olympics, in baseball. Black baseball teams barnstormed across the United States, and whites went to watch them. White sports writers and white spectators attended the Negro League All-Star Games. Spectators, many of them whites, cheered the black players, recognizing them for their skill and talents. This kind of acclaim did not repeat itself elsewhere in America. But little was ever said about the color line in baseball that kept blacks out of the major leagues. Little was said about the bigotry in baseball unless a player violated the conspiracy of silence. This leads me to another one of my lessons. Just because a fact is repeated over and over, it doesn't make it a fact. Jake Powell, an outfielder for the New York Yankees, told the Chicago White Sox announcer before a game in the summer of 1938 that he stayed in shape in the offseason as a cop in Dayton, Ohio, by cracking Negroes over the head with his nightstick. He didn't use the word Negroes. I examined the coverage of the Powell story and wrote an academic article about it in an op-ed column for the Dayton Daily News and mentioned Powell being a cop in Dayton. A police officer in Dayton wrote a letter to the editor that said he had checked the employment records and found that Powell had never been a police officer in Dayton. My initial thought was that Sergeant Wheeler was trying to protect the department. Sergeant Wheeler was right. I was wrong, but how did I make that mistake? Baseball scholars had reported this story in their books and articles. Dozens of newspapers had mentioned the Powell story and said he was a cop in Dayton. Sports writers took the word of a racist as fact, and so did I. I then went back and looked at the newspapers, and I found that two newspapers that actually contacted the Dayton Police Department, the Dayton Forum, a black newspaper, and the Daily Worker, a communist newspaper, and they were told by the Dayton Police Department that Powell was not now or had ever been a police officer in the city. Powell later took his own life in Washington, D.C. police station after cashing Ford's checks. He was with his fiance at the time, even though he was legally married to a woman in Dayton. Jake Powell was quite a catch. I erred in perpetuating the mistake that Jake Powell worked for the Dayton Daily News. I corrected that in my next book, Conspiracy of Silence, Sports Writers and the Long Campaign to Desegregate Baseball. In the book, I mentioned Bob Hasty, a pitcher for the Philadelphia Athletics who was identified as participating in an incident where a man and woman were flogged near Hasty's hometown in rural Georgia in late 1923. I based this reference on a well-respected historian in my own research of Hasty in contemporary accounts in newspapers, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and in the Sporting News. This was during the heyday of the second iteration of the Klan, and the Klan was popular in rural Georgia. It was the second iteration was started in Atlanta. Hasty lived in rural Georgia. The incident involved a flogging which, in newspaper reports, presumed an attack by whites on blacks. Hasty was identified as a Klansman and savaged in a few articles in the press. I received an email from Hasty's granddaughter who demanded a retraction. I initially believed the woman was defending the family name, and this may have been honorable, but that she was probably wrong. She emailed me additional articles, and I went back and dug deeper and deeper into the story. Hasty was identified by the victim of the attack, but Hasty had an alibi and was never arrested, never charged, and did not stand trial. The man and woman in the flogging incident were not black. They were white. It was not an act of Klan violence, and Hasty, as far as I know, was not a Klansman. The Klan had expanded its hate, so much hate, had expanded its hate from blacks to blacks and Jews and Catholics and immigrants in the 1920s. Hasty's granddaughter told me that her grandfather had a really good relationship with Connie Mack until this. They had fallen out of favor with Mack because Mack was a Roman Catholic and hated the Klan. Hasty had his best year of a mediocre career in 1923, the season that ended after the flogging, the season that ended before the flogging. He won one game in 1924 and never pitched again in the majors. I will revisit Hasty in my next book. Here's what, when I think about the fact that I've been working in this research for 30 years, one thing comes to mind. I'm old. I don't get hung up on racist ball players like I used to, because they had little to do with the preserving of the color line. I direct my indignation at the baseball establishment, who knew there were black players who could play in the major leagues, who would improve the game, who would increase attendance at the ballparks, and they did nothing. I blame Kennesaw Mountain Landis and his cronies, team owners, and league executives Ford Frick, J.G. Taylor Spink, the editor of the Sporting News, and influential sports writers who protected the color line with their silence and, when necessary, their lies. A couple years ago, the Baseball Writers Association of America remembered removed Spink's name from the J.G. Taylor Spink Award for meritorious contributions to baseball writing. The winner receives his or her name in the writer's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame. The award is still given. Spink's name is no longer on it. A year earlier, the Baseball Writers Association removed Landis's name from the MVP awards. These two men willingly participated in the greatest sin that baseball has ever perpetrated, the color line. I'm glad the Baseball Writers Association did this. This was the right thing to do. We do justice to the past and to the present when we address our sins and transgressions. History is what happens, no Governor DeSantis. History is not something we come up with to whitewash our transgressions. History tells us who we are and how we got here. History, as I've learned from 30 years, is the process of trying to address untold stories, to correct the mistakes of other historians, and sometimes this means addressing and correcting our own mistakes. Thank you. We have questions. If you also want to ask me about the Cincinnati Reds, that would be fun. It's yes.
I got here first. Chris, thank you so much. It is so important to tell the truth about this history. And I am struck by the parallels between what you focus on, the history of black players in baseball and how they were kept out by people like Kenesaw Mountain Landis and other characters, how many parallels there are to the way that particularly black women ball players in the early part of the 20th century were treated in the press. It's awful. Yeah. Dismissive, sexist, racist, every element of, you know, bad humanity. And I think there's a rich opportunity for exploration in the untold story of this underground network of black women ballplayers playing on factory teams during World War II that the new Amazon series, A League of Their Own, has just barely touched on. So anyway, thank you for that. I'm just really grateful to you for that.
Thank you. And I include Tony Stone's book in my grad class at where I teach. And that would, if you're interested in learning more, Tony Stone is rather remarkable. Yes.
Okay. On the subject, you brought up the subject of quote-unquote passing and players being asked to. And we had a situation in Connecticut with a player by the name of Johnny Taylor, who we recently honored in Hartford. Johnny Taylor was a schoolboy star. He was known as Schoolboy Johnny Taylor. He could have signed with the New York Yankees, tried to pass for a Cuban, quote, quote. But he decided not to. He decided he would honor his black heritage. He was that proud of it. He played several years in the Negro Leagues with the New York Cubans. Finally, at the end of his playing days, he played 1949 in the Eastern League with the Hartford team. There are probably many other similar stories of what the people were doing to keep blacks out of the game and what the attitudes were in those days.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I would like to find out more about him. So, yeah, in Germany, they teach their students the Holocaust. It would be nice if we taught our students more about Jim Crow and segregation, yes.
Good morning. Hi. Thanks for such a good talk. Could you talk a little bit about the timing of Landis's death? He died in 1944, and then Robinson broke in 46, 47, right? That's probably not a coincidence, right?
No. No, I don't think so. And Ricky knew that. I just don't think it would have been, that baseball would have been in a great, and for one thing, it happened in kind of a tweener between, you know, Chandler was in transition, and who would have thought that a segregationist governor would have been the one who sort of allowed this? But I in a World War II made a huge difference. But no, Landis was a racist, and there's so much indication. Yes, thank you.
Well, I appreciated the talk. I'm not going to restart a whole debate about Landis. At the time of the Ken Burns documentary about Jackie Robinson, which took the position you took, I researched it, wrote something about it that was published, and it took quite a different view. Among other things, Landis, as I'm sure you know, in 1943, did make the statement that it's not true that there's a color line in baseball, and if anybody wants to sign a black player, they can go ahead and do it. But I do want to say something to you as a presenter, that if you're going to attack Landis, which is your right, and if you're going to talk at length about the Jake Powell incident, wouldn't it be fair to point out that Landis suspended Jake Powell for making those remarks?
Yes, and a Daily Worker called on Landis to suspend himself.
Well.
But also, yeah, I see what you're, I've had this discussion, is that Landis was sent so many letters and so many phone calls, and he ignored them. William Clarence Matthews reached out to Landis. Landis ignored him. For years, Sam Lacy reached out to Landis. The Daily Worker sent petitions with what they called hundreds of thousands of names to Landis, saying, you know, what will you address this? Landis.
Excuse me, now you're talking about the caller line, not Jake Powell, right?
Oh, no, right now I'm talking about Landis.
Yep. No, yep. You're talking about all these thousands of letters were about the caller line. They weren't about Jake Powell.
They were about, yeah, Jake Powell, but remember, yeah. Landis did what he had to do. That this created such an uproar that it created such an uproar in Chicago, which is where he was.
Yeah.
Low-hanging fruit. He could have, and he knew about, race. He could have addressed this issue. There's no evidence. Well, let me not say that. There's little evidence that Kennesaw Mann as being the all-powerful man, made any, to integrate baseball or to make it possible to integrate. There's a lot of things he could have done, and the fact of the I'm sorry. I should let you talk.
No. I don't have anything more to say.
Okay. But thank you. I need to hear that because the next book I'm going to go into Landis's.
I guess I have one more thing to say. Okay. In the era of racism, the presumption was among so many Americans, although never all, blacks are presumed guilty. We are now in a new era in which whites are presumed guilty. I reject that as well. That's all.
Okay, thank you.
That's partly because I often hear from even people like Hillary Clinton talking about her parents, every white person in the 50s was racist. Well, the white people I knew in the 50s were not racist. They were very concerned with Negro equality and other forms of equality.
And in agreement with you is William Manchester warned us against a generation of chauvinism,
yeah.
Where we don't use the same criteria in one generation.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Thank you, sir. Yeah, good.